All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
And I saw Groundhog Day on Groundhog Day, so that was another Michael Shannon that popped up.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Not that I mind a slight case of abduction now and then, but I have tickets for the theater this evening, to a show I was looking forward to. And I get, well, kind of unreasonable about things like that.
With such expert play acting, you make this very room a theater.
Hello, everybody. This is episode 151 of Wreckatopia. We're joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely-ho, Eva Marinarinos.
Ooh, I love that one. That's a good one. That's a classic one right there. We're also joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hi, everybody.
Jeremy's iron. I'm Chris Atkinson. Today's big recommend is North by Northwest. Can't wait to get into that. We'd also like to welcome Chat, who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Thank you very, very much for coming out and watching us be goofballs. Let's go on to our small recommends. Aaron, start us off.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
I'm going to small recommend an animated film from the year 1997 called Perfect Blue. This is the top movie, top rated movie on Letterboxd that I hadn't seen yet. And so I decided to knock it off my list. It is a horror mystery animated film. It's a tight 80 minutes, so it's not, you know, a lengthy watch. It's Satoshi Kon is the director, and I believe one of his earliest. This may be one of the most intricate and well-crafted psychological thrillers I've ever seen. It is really smart, really interesting, really adult, by the way, as well. I should just kind of give you some warning what you're walking into, but it is anime. Like, it feels, you know, the animation style makes it feel the same as you might expect from other animated films, but it's very mature and different, and more than anything, interesting in the way the plot takes you through different paths of understanding what's going on. I guess the one thing I will say is this movie plays with an increasingly unreliable narrator better than I've seen any movie do it. And so it's a really interesting film. Mm. Definitely recommend it. Definitely see why it's so high up on people's lists.
A lot of our chat has heard of this movie, but I have not heard of this movie ever. And it always makes me happy that there are these just like, there's these tremendously great appreciated movies out there that somehow have completely missed me over the years. And now I definitely want to see this. Now it's on my list of having to watch. And yeah, I can't wait to watch it now. I love the thumbnail that is on this for people who can see it. But I'm gonna get into that.
So. Somebody in the chat says more adult than heavy metal. Yes, but differently adult. Heavy metal is just kind of like, look, we can animate boobs. This is much more of an actual story.
Now look, far be it from me to be the guy to defend heavy metal.
But here I go.
But I do think it has a little more to say than, look, we can animate boobs. That being said, that is a movie that I wish I had come to in my teenage years, which is when it's perfect for a male to watch. Instead, I saw it at like 26, and I was like, this is stupid. I wasn't like titillated by it at all. I was like, man, if I'd have seen this when I was 15, that would have been the jam.
Well, that's what I'm. It's adolescently adult, weird, like a weirdly
right, yes.
type of, you know, like it. It. I mean, it is kind of got that same syndrome that, you know, Logan has, where it's like, ooh, we're an R-rated comic book movie. Let's put the word fuck in there. Let's put boobies in
time
there.
For a shower.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So anyway, definitely want to see this. I am glad you, how did you run across this? Oh, that was the Letterbox, right?
Yeah, it was on Letterbox. Occasionally I'll look and see, you know, the top, you know, movies on Letterbox all time and see what the number one I haven't seen is. So. Yep.
All right. I will small recommend a movie that came out, I think, last week. It's called Companion. It stars Sophie Thatcher, who you may know from Yellow Jackets. It also stars Jack Quaid, who's still Jack Quaid from The Boys, but man, he has been in a million things in the past couple of years. It's almost hard to just say he's from The Boys now, but that's the most popular thing he's attached to, and he's much more than just Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan's kid at this point, I'm guessing. But Companion is a movie that's almost like, you know, the girl from Ex Machina like came out and went out into the world, and then somebody like found her and then created their own thing out of it, and then made a whole like industry out of it. Safer Ex Machinas than the ones that were in that movie. But this is a movie where there's a bunch of people going on basically it's just like a trip to this house in the like distant woods. It's like somewhat close to a pond, but not really. And Jack Quaid has brought his girlfriend Iris, played by Sophie Thatcher, and there is a gay couple, and then there's a Russian guy with his maybe girlfriend. We don't know. It doesn't seem to be defined in any kind of a way. It comes to a head when, and this is one of those movies that you don't want to say too much about, but even though you know from the trailer that she's a robot, they keep calling her a fuckbot all the way
through. People who watch trailers know from the trailer that was the case. Yes.
Yes, yes, Aaron. We know you're superior to us. Yes, yes. We know you're superior to us in every way, Aaron. We get it. No, I'm just kidding. It comes to a head when Iris kills the Russian guy who tries to make advances on her. And this sort of leads to kind of a mystery, because a kind of a mystery, it doesn't last long, but how does a robot that is programmed not to kill people or hurt people do that anyway? And so it gets to this point where, like, now we've come to a head. Now, I don't want to say much more about the movie, because you do want to kind of like get into the surprises and everything of this, but I was really shocked at how good this movie was. I was not expecting something this good and this fun. I don't know what it is. In the past 10, 15 years, it seems like every movie about a robot I enjoy. And you get the Wild Robot, you got Big Hero 6, you got
Megan.
Megan. Yeah, I loved Megan.
I thought that was really fun.
Yeah,
Robot
Megan
Dreams.
Was a lot of fun.
Did you see Robot Dreams?
I have not seen Robot Dreams, but I'm assuming that I'll love it, because everything about robots is amazing these days. I don't know what the deal is, but some really good performances here from Sophie Thatcher and Jack Quaid, who is, I think, destined to just kind of become a big movie star at some point, because I don't know how this Novocaine's going to play like later on in the year, but he seems to be everywhere. And so this is just well worth it. I didn't think it would be good. So I'm recommending it here now.
Same. It's awesome. I loved the experience of this movie. And yes, I do realize my no trailers thing is kind of like my veganism. You know, like nobody wants to hear about it. We get it. You know, it's healthier, whatever. But this movie specifically is one of those movies where I'm so thankful that I don't watch trailers, because it is designed as a reveal. The robot thing is designed as a reveal in the movie that mm-hmm. is so nuanced and interesting because now you know this because you knew going in mm-hmm. that she was. I didn't, but there are moments leading up to that reveal where people are treating her differently, saying things to her that your brain's going, man, they do not like her. What is going on with this? And it's a real shocker of a reveal, and it blew my mind. It's my favorite movie moment of this very young year.
Yeah,
that reveal. It's really, really good.
That's the weird. I don't know what you would want to call it. There's a paradox to this where you're talking about like, yes, it would be great if everybody went to watch this movie without watching the trailer. I do agree with this, by the way. I was just making fun of you.
Yeah.
But how are you going to get people to come watch this movie you tell them that it's like, you can get you to watch it because it's sort of your job to watch it. But like, you know, for everybody else, it's like, well, if I don't know that this girl's a robot, why would I want to watch this?
If I didn't have any kind of idea, if I just had a title and a poster, I would be paralyzed to even make a choice of what movie to see.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. And that's why it really is one of those things where I think it's, you know, for me, it's like, I know I enjoy movies better this way, and I'm going to see most stuff anyway, so it makes sense for my movie-going lifestyle. Like, that totally makes sense. And I feel like I get a higher level of experience, especially out of a movie like this. Now, I will say, as the chat has mentioned, I was going to mention as well, this movie has plenty of surprises beyond that. So, mm-hmm. like, you're still in for some really good surprise-based storytelling that is structured really well. Everybody's acting's really great. It's funny. It's hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
And the technology is fun to watch, too. Like, I really, really like this movie.
And I won't spoil the line in it, but it's going to be very hard to beat the reaction that Jack Quaid has when he says something that he doesn't realize is a joke until after he said it, and then smiles at it, almost it looks so organic, it just occurred to Jack Quaid himself, not the character. That's how good that moment is. That I don't know if it can get beaten for like one of the funniest things I've seen this year. It's a really high bar, but anyway, it is really good. So I highly recommend it.
Absolutely.
Jeremy, what do you got?
Well, I can't use two highlies to recommend mine.
Well, then yours doesn't qualify.
It's a tough act to follow the two of you, like best animated movie ever I've never heard of, and then, you know, robot girlfriend. Heartily. I saw a movie this week called 99 Homes. It's from 2014, and it stars Michael Shannon and Andrew Garfield, and I really enjoyed it. Andrew Garfield is basically, you know, a guarantee to get me to watch at this point. I'm very invested in his career and his talent and his acting choices. This is a movie where his mom's Laura Dern, and he lives with her and his son. And he's divorced, and they get evicted by Michael Shannon. And then Andrew Garfield goes to Michael Shannon's office to get back some of his tools. He's a construction worker. Get back some of his tools that Michael Shannon's henchmen basically stole. And Michael Shannon likes his gumption. So he puts him to work and says, how would you like to do construction work on homes that I have foreclosed on and am selling? He takes the job because he has no other income. And that just begins a slippery slope to will he or will he not become what Michael Shannon is, the journey that he and his family take as he gets pulled further and further into the world of foreclosing on poor people. I was really, really moved at times by this. I really enjoyed it. And solid drama. It's on Tubi. It's on all the free places. So Tubi and Plex and stuff like that, if you'd like to give it a watch. I heartily recommend.
Well, I heartily recommend it. It was one of my top movies of 2014. And I think it's prescient in many ways, or prescient. I never remember how to pronounce that word.
Both are good.
Maybe one day I will remember, and this will all be a prescient memory of that. Anyways, it's great. And Andrew Garfield is great in it, as is not a surprise. So, yeah, I recommend for me as well.
Yeah, at first, when I saw the thumbnail, I was like, for sure, this is the same guy who did, what was it, Take Shelter? That was the other Michael Shannon movie where he's creating like a a bomb shelter, and it's like way too expensive for him to actually do, and he still does it anyway. There's a lot of conflicts, but it's not the same guy. It just looked I saw the thumbnail, and I was like, oh, that must be that same guy who did Take Shelter.
There's been a lot of Michael Shannon coming from my mouth lately, because he was in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, mm-hmm. and he's mm-hmm. even in A Different Man, which I small recommended last week.
Yeah, I was about to say, I've had a lot of Michael Shannon in my life, and I saw Groundhog Day on Groundhog Day, so that was another Michael Shannon that popped up. So there you go. All right, let's get on to our big recommend.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Which is North by Northwest, and it is Aaron's. So take it away, Aaron.
All right. North by Northwest is Alfred Hitchcock's 46th film. It's based on an Ernest Lehman screenplay. It was released in 1959, made almost $10 million, which doubled its shooting cost and would be equivalent to $108 million today, putting it in the likes of, let's see, in 2024, the Mean Girls remake, Madame Web, and a movie that I'd never heard of called Detective Conan, the Million Dollar Pentagram, which made $108 million last year.
Well, I'm watching it now.
So basically it bombed.
It did not. It was well received both by the public and the critics. It actually was tied for the number six movie of that year financially, so it wasn't too bad. The movie begins as a lion on a pea soup green MGM background roars to usher us into some Bernard Herrmann genius and some parallel lines that we'll eventually realize are the windows of a skyscraper. Masses of humanity walk through the New York streets in subways, and eventually a random man of no consequence misses the bus. We now meet Cary Grant's Roger Thornhill, talking a mile a minute to his assistant and giving us the impression that he is a very busy and snarky man. He eventually finds his way to a meeting where he promises to drink a lot. He also signals for an errand boy to send a message, which inadvertently signifies his new role as Hitchcock's favorite trope, the innocent man in a dangerous situation, often called the wrong man trope. He is then manhandled by a couple of men who handle the man straight to a car and onto a mansion. He snoops around a bit, finds some mail for a Townsend as the hench fellas go to fetch James Mason, who thinks Roger is some guy named Kaplan, and then insists he's hiding secrets from him. Thornhill says he's going to leave because he needs to get to the Winter Garden Theater, and hey, I saw Hugh Jackman as Henry Hill there. Wait, what was I talking about again? Oh, right. Arsenic and old lace is being held by Bela Lugosi and force-fed some scotch so they can make it seem like he died in a drunk driving accident. However, drunk Kaplan gets the best of the sober henchies and manages to drunkenly drive himself to safety by creating a police car sandwich. Of course, the police think all the true things he's saying are drunk lies because he's acting so drunk, and also he's hilarious. But then a judge is finally willing to call for some detectives to actually do some detecting and to check it out. Of course, once they go to the house, the fix is in, the couch cushions are all cleaned, and the alcohol is now stored in books. So Thornhill decides to do some personal detective work of his own with his equally snarky mother. They head back to the hotel to see if George Kaplan is there, and yes, he has a room, but the beds haven't been slept in, according to the nosy maids. There is, however, a picture in the room that points back to Thornhill's captors, and apparently no one has even ever met this Mr. Kaplan. The killers then show up for a nice game of elevator laughing. Thornhill then takes a trip to the UN to see what's going on there and manages to discover Townsend isn't who he thought he was, and also suddenly has a knife in his back that Thornhill decides to grab and hold menacingly to pose for a nearby photographer. Meanwhile, at the CIA, we get some important exposition that this so-called Kaplan is actually a decoy agent meant to pull the now-named Van Damme out from hiding. And seeing as they can't give up the hunt just yet, apparently Thornhill is all on his own. Thornhill, now using the Clark Kent handbook for disguising things, has a pair of sunglasses on, which is enough to get him on a train, where a smitten Eva Marie Saint helps him evade the fuzz. Thornhill later finds her again in the diner car, finds out her name is Eve, that she knows who he is, and also they should order drinks now because it's obvious they are both extremely thirsty. The train makes an unscheduled stop, and some policemen get on, so Eve hides Roger in her fold-up bed so she can smoothly handle the police questions and keep him safe. Meanwhile, this probably wasn't the type of being bedded Thornhill was hoping for. But it's okay because he's about to get the type of Rogering he was. The penetrating dialogue then double entendres on for all the sometime, not that anyone is complaining. But a guilty glance and a pass note let us know that Eve is actually a honeypot working for Van Damme, and Thornhill got his honey wand stuck right in it. Also, apparently shaving cream is as good a police deterrent as sunglasses. Eve gives Roger his instructions to take a bus to the middle of nowhere, apparently so that Van Damme can kill him in the most efficient way possible via an iconic crop duster plane attack. The two of them play some cat plane and man mouse for a while before Roger manages to use a tanker truck as an exploding shield. He then steals a car and makes his way back to the hotel, where he finds out that Kaplan had already checked out and realizes that Eve is playing him. He finds Eve at the hotel, and she keeps up the charade, but we get a sense that he has a suspicion that she's actually notorious, and he may not want to have her bring up his baby after all. She then asks him to run away. He insists on dinner, and she insists he get his suit cleaned. He takes a shower by whistling the theme from one of only two movies I actually consider better than this one. Weird that he knew the Finding Nemo theme. Once she leaves, he uses the old pencil on the pad trick to get the address of where she has gone. He tracks her to an auction and now confronts her with Van Damme and his various Jean-Claudes. He tells them he's going to the police because he's probably safer there, but they threaten him, so he causes a scene and gets himself safely escorted out as a CIA agent we saw earlier makes a phone call. Roger tells the police they hit the jackpot, but the Chicago PD has other plans as they hand him off to the CIA to get on a plane going, that's right, north via Northwest, because apparently the CIA flies commercial. And now the movie is ready to head to Mount Rushmore for its finale. Thornhill doesn't want to go, but once he finds out that Eve is actually a double agent that he may have put in danger, he decides to go along with the plan. What's the plan, you ask? Simple. Thornhill will attempt to exchange his silence for the ability to take Eve and punish her as she deserves, but once he tries, Eve will fake shoot him in the Mount Rushmore cafeteria. It goes perfectly, even though a little boy CIA agent almost gives it away by pre-plugging his ears.
He does.
Eve and Roger get a meeting in the woods where they reconcile before finding out that the goal is for Eve to leave with Van Damme as a fugitive. Roger is against this, but there isn't much he can do about it without getting punched in the face, which is apparently the best way to subdue someone in 1959. Thornhill then escapes out the window of his hospital and quickly takes a taxi to Van Damme's place so he can save the day. But considering the CIA agent said they were leaving so quickly, I would have thought he would have had to rush more. But it's a good thing he got there in time because he hears Van Damme and Leonard talking, and Leonard is absolutely on to Eve. Turns out he found out that Eve was shooting blanks, which of course was best conveyed by pretending to loudly shoot his boss without warning and with her standing in the next room. Roger then decides the only way he can communicate with her is through Chekhov's monogrammed matchbook, which somehow works. Thornhill gets spotted by the maid in a TV reflection, and she holds him at gunpoint while we fear that Eve is going to get forced onto the plane. But Thornhill finally realizes it's still the prop gun, and as Eve sees him run out of the house, she yoinks the MacGuffin stuffed art piece, and they make a run for it. Unfortunately, the car path is blocked, so they proceed on foot and do the only reasonable thing, which is climb down the faces of the Mount Rushmore Monument.
What other choice do they have?
Really, what else were they going to do, honestly? Eve slips and grabs Roger's pants pocket, but the tailor must have not given him the double stitch after all, because it just rips and she falls to her mildly annoying lower perch. Eventually, the chase brings Thornhill face-to-face with Van Damme's henchies, but he manages to Simba one of them off the edge. Then Eve is dangling from the edge, and Thornhill is holding her, and Leonard decides to stand on Roger's hand to kill them both, but the CIA show up to shoot Leonard just in time, because you can't spell Ex Machina without the CIA. Otherwise, it would just be Ex Thornhill finally manages... Thornhill finally manages to not cliffhanger Eve and pulls her up onto a train bed just in time for a final tunnel-based innuendo. And that is North by Northwest. Guys, what did you think this time through?
Jeremy, go ahead.
All right. Well, I'm going to start with what is clearly the most important thing about this movie. He orders brook trout on a train.
Yes, he does.
Which is troubling to begin with. But that brook trout arrives less than 60 seconds later.
That's how you do it, man.
That means it was sitting in a warmer and all they did was plate it. That is rubber fish. I can't... really bothered by that fish. I love this movie. I'm going to say something that sounds hurtful, but I don't mean it to be hurtful. Watching this movie for this podcast just helped me realize how much Rear Window is my favorite Hitchcock movie.
Okay.
And I think it has more to do with, this is very James Bondian, and I think it's even something he was attempting to do in making this movie, was make like a James Bond movie on his own, like that wasn't James, I don't know. But
it would have been the first James Bond movie. If it were.
Oh, there weren't any James Bond movies, Bond?
There were books, but no movies.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm just talking out of my ass. But there's so much. If you just read the description of what happens, particularly the last 20 minutes, microfish inside of a statue, it is bonkers. But all of the Hitchcock trademarks are there in terms of the way he shoots things, setting up the tension, building, letting it simmer when it needs to. Cary Grant is amazing. I think this movie's outstanding. I can't stop thinking about Rear Window whenever I watch this movie because I think it accomplishes a lot of the same things without having to be so fantastical. And maybe the fantastical is why people adore this more than I do. But it sounds like I'm ragging on this movie, but it's an A+. I got almost nothing bad to say. Well, once we get past the brook trout and the final, when that train goes in the tunnel at the end, I started laughing out loud. I cannot believe this movie ends that way. And I don't know how much of a trope that was when this movie was made.
I don't think it was.
Or if he invented it?
He says he invented it. In fact, Ernest Lehman, the screenwriter, in interviews would say, I wish I had invented that, but Hitchcock invented that. He was the first person to use that. So
that's insane. It's insane. Yep. Now that because of what that has become now, it's hard to watch even in its first inception and not laugh at it. Okay.
In its conception, you mean?
Yes.
Sorry.
Sometimes I forget that one of the three hosts of this show is a wordplay enthusiast. No, I don't actually ever forget that. When he grabs that knife in the dude's back at the UN, that is the most Murder, She Wrote, Matlock thing, Perry Mason thing. Because those shows, my dad watched those shows when I was growing up, so I watched those shows. And they always had to paint the defendant into this corner where the jury would just assume they're guilty so that the lawyer can then do lawyer stuff. So they always touch the murder weapon. Their prints are always on the murder weapon. And so when he grabs it, I'm like, you stupid son of a bitch. I love the music here. I love the painted backgrounds that you can tell are painted, but are so beautiful you don't care that they're painted. There's so much classical filmmaking here that we just don't get anymore. Like, not to mention those opening titles, which you mentioned. But I wish we got more movies that did that. I mean, the last movie that had opening titles that were memorable to me was Seven, and that was 28 years ago.
Yeah, the guy who did it here is Saul Bass, who did the West Side Story opening credits.
So, yeah, you can tell. That overhead shot, I'm sorry, I just have bullet points. The overhead shot when he runs from the UN building after being snapped in the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
It's so amazing. there's so much to gawk at in a Hitchcock film, but especially this one.
Mm-hmm.
I love the setup. I love the setup that he's racing to find Kaplan and Kaplan doesn't actually exist. You don't see that too often in spy thrillers. Usually, like a lesser movie, Kaplan would just be a real guy. But this movie wraps it in on itself. Every single exterior shot of the train is on the right-hand side of a body of water with mountains, but this train is going from New York to Chicago. No, I don't buy it. I also think, I know the airline is Northwest, but if you just take the line from New York and his journey, the movie should be called West by Northwest, because New York to Chicago is straight up west. There's no...
Well, I think technically isn't the idea that North by Northwest isn't a direction? Like, like, apparently it's a nonsense thing to people who, like, use maps and stuff. So, like, the idea is that they're, you know, it's fake.
But
it doesn't exist.
But there is apparently a Northwest by North.
Correct. Northwest by North is a thing, but North by Northwest isn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why?
It's a good question. We should go back and ask people who invented it.
Mm-hmm.
I love the phone booth conversation in the train station where they're each in different booths talking to each other on the phone. The crop duster scene, I don't know where they shot that, but that is exactly what Illinois and Indiana looks like. And
apparently it was Bakersfield, California, where they did
that's
that.
Insane.
Yeah, they created a cornfield for it so that they could shoot it there. I think that's what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
I love the crop duster foreshadowing as it builds. He gets off the bus and you can see it. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy he meets is like, that crop duster's dusting, but there ain't no crops. And you're like, oh, that's not quite right. The buildup in that scene is just perfect. I don't understand the plane crashing into the oil tanker. I'll take it. Our hero needs the win. But I feel like that pilot flew straight into that thing on purpose. I'm not sure how that happened.
Yeah.
I did note the sunglasses, Aaron, and how he Clark Kent's himself. Like, he doesn't even put on a hat. And when he does get a new suit, it's gray, like the suit he was wearing previously. It's the same kind of suit. I love the auction. I wrote, the auction stunt is fun, but it goes on too long, considering how fast he got that brook trout. one of my favorite bits in the entire movie is when they're walking outside at the airport and the jet engine noise near them keeps us from hearing their conversation while they have their conversation. It is a much more nuanced way to do, here's what we're going to do, and fade away. Because we get to see they're making a plan, but we don't know what it is. So I love that. I wrote that this movie's climax may be the only good thing to come out of the creation of Mount Rushmore. worth mentioning, Mount Rushmore was called the Six Grandfathers by the Lakota Sioux long before anyone came along to carve white presidents' faces into it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I've said all that. I've said all that. Oh, the movie greatly exaggerates the terrain on top of Mount Rushmore. Like, you can't just walk through the woods and end up on top of Mount Rush. Like, it's all Rocky Mountain up there. But again, we don't get that finale if they don't get up there. So I'm willing to let it go. I wrote down some IMDb trivia stuff that I thought was kind of interesting. Like that woods at the end of the movie, he just planted 100 trees on the MGM soundstage. That's insanity. And I guess it was just way more expensive to go to wherever those trees exist naturally. The UN painting thing, that shows up in the movie, and I pause it. I'm like, that looks like a painting. So I Google the UN lobby, and it looks exactly like what's in the movie. And I was like, huh, interesting. And I kind of forgot about it till I'm going through the trivia, and yeah, it was a painting. They were denied access to film inside the UN. And also, the note from IMDb says Thornhill appears on the left side of the screen for almost the entire movie. And I think that's a fascinating choice, and I'm not sure what it means, but I like it.
That sounds like one of those things that somebody just noticed, and maybe if Hitchcock had been told that, he'd be like, oh, that's kind of cool. I didn't necessarily mean to do that, but...
It could be.
It's funny, I was in a philosophy and film class watched this movie, and there was a philosophical paper that we read about it, and this guy goes off on all the things that are in North by Northwest that you never would think of, and after hearing the commentary on this disc that I have, and Ernest Lehman is the commentary on this one. And that guy wrote a lot of stuff that he got nominated 4 times for writing. North by Northwest, I think, was his first nomination. But he also wrote The Sweet Smell of Success, is a movie that I've thought about making a big recommend at one point. He wrote the screenplay for West Side Story. He wrote the one for Sound of Music. And he's gotten nominated a couple other times. But when you hear it from Lehman and Hitchcock themselves, reading into this movie about any kind of deep meaning or anything is ludicrous, apparently. They didn't have any deep meaning in there, which is so funny when you read this. I will recommend this. You're going to roll your eyes a bunch reading it when you find it, but find Stanley Cavell's North by Northwest philosophical paper about this, because he talks about how this movie seems to be kind of a comment on Cary Grant's acting, because so many different characters come up to him and tell him that, oh, you do such a great job acting, and you do, and it's a lot of like talk about that. And there's even a talk about like how this interconnects with other movies like The 39 Steps and Notorious, and even in The Philadelphia Story, which apparently there's a scene in Philadelphia Story. I haven't seen this movie in forever, but Cary Grant is an alcoholic in that movie who turns to books to get away from his alcoholism, which is there's that scene in North by Northwest where we're supposed to see a whole bunch of alcohol, but there's a bunch of books behind. This is something this guy found that's just it's kind of insane. I don't think they were thinking of this type of thing when they did it. And, there's a lot of talk about the title itself, which is also meaningless. A lot of people try to bring Hamlet into it, and so does this philosopher. He brings in Hamlet, and apparently Hamlet has roots in some other story before Hamlet that came out in, like, Danish tradition and everything. He said, here's what we're really going to compare this movie to, the characters that are in that thing as compared to Hamlet, as to compare to this. A lot of, like, really fun stuff. So if you ever want to see the Stanley Cavell thing, you can look it up online. But I really love this movie. I used to have this on VHS back in the day, and the little roster of VHS tapes that I had, I used to watch this just countless times. And so I've probably seen it a good 15, 16 times or whatever now. I'm never like sitting there going, man, this is boring. This is bad in any way. This on this go round though, because we're on this podcast and we're Cinema Sins and all this other type of stuff. That crop duster scene, you alluded to it, Aaron, the most efficient way to kill someone, also the dumbest way to try to kill someone. I mean, it just, if you're trying to make his death look accidental, this is not the way to do
it. It's the worst plan ever.
Yeah, it's really, really dumb. I mean, really, honestly, if they wanted to do that, they might as well have just gotten a car and drove past the bus stop and gave a drive-by and then moved on. But would you change a thing about this scene? You wouldn't.
Nope.
Ernest Lehman was talking about this too. He talked about the absurdity of them shooting bullets at him and everything as well. But he said, there's 8 minutes of nothing going on here. He's just standing there at the bus stop and there's nothing. But you're riveted because it's what we're going to finally see this Kaplan guy or not. What's going to happen to him? I think at this point we know Kaplan's not real. So we're really wondering what's going to happen when someone does come by. But But like it, that scene is so awesome. It's like, what would you change it? Would you take it out now? But knowing that it's not a really, that it's a really dumb way to try to kill someone. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't take it out. I love Eva Marie Saint a lot. I can fall in love with her every single time I watch this movie. She's still kicking, by the way. She's 100 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. She is, I think she's probably my favorite Hitchcock heroine. You have Grace Kelly in there too. Those are the two top ones, but, just from sheer acting ability, I think I like Eva Marie Saint, more than Grace Kelly, but she's so good. And I love that interplay between she and Cary Grant all throughout this. There's this just, you know, just very magnetic all the way through. So I love that. You guys have already talked about like most of the stuff that I would talk about with this movie. I do love the shot too, when they discover that, when Martin Landau finally discovers that, you know, that Eve is a double agent, and the camera is just above he and James Mason, and he says, we're going to have to solve this problem from a great height. And the camera starts moving up, and as a punchline, he's like, over water, you know? So like, you know, I love all that type of stuff in there too. It's just really, really inventive camera work that, you know, that is just all Hitchcock. And I highly, highly enjoy this movie. I don't know what else to say about it. It's just so good.
There's so much, and you guys have talked about a lot of it. I will say one of my favorite pieces of trivia is that Jimmy Stewart really wanted to do this movie, apparently, and Hitchcock kind of had to play some games to make sure he wasn't available to do the movie so that he could cast who he wanted to cast, which is interesting. I think Cary Grant is great in this, and I think of all the Hitchcock team-ups that they did, he is allowed to be most himself in this movie. Sense of humor, especially, like, this is the Cary Grant from Arsenic and Old Lace. Like, this is the Cary Grant who was a comedy star, you know, before he was working with Hitchcock and everything. He is so funny in that courtroom scene. It slays me. Now, a lot of that is writing, but a lot of that is just he is a good performer. He understands physical comedy. He understands spoken comedy. He and Eva Marie understand that genius, clever double entendre stuff that's going on in every single one of their conversations. And it just all works so well. As mentioned, I mean, clearly I'm, you know, in the tank for this movie, in the exploding gas tank for this movie, because it's my number 3 movie of all time. I think it is Hitchcock's best film, and I think it is his best film because he went into it not trying to be metaphorical and meaningful. And like he came off of Vertigo, I think, before this. And with Vertigo, he was very like in the meanings and the layers and the metaphors and the messages. And here he just wanted to do a fun movie. This is like his popcorn movie in many ways. He wanted to do a spy movie. And in many ways, you know, Jeremy, you talk about the Bond stuff. He invented the spy movie with this movie in many ways, the modern spy movie, I should say. And I think, you know, when Bond came along a couple years later, they definitely took a lot of, you know, tricks from what Hitchcock did in North by Northwest. And in many ways, this is the first and best Bond movie in some ways. So, yeah, I think there's a reason the crop duster scene is so iconic. And I think it goes back to something we were talking about. I mean, there are several reasons, but one of the main ones goes back to something we were talking about with Duel, which is Hitchcock very specifically chose not to show the pilot of the plane in the entirety of that scene. The plane is the monster. He knew if he showed the pilot, it becomes man on man. And he wanted it to be plain on man. And that makes a ton of difference because now it's just he's escaping a dragon at this point. You know what I mean? Like it's not Whereas most movies would feel the need to show you the emotion of the pilot and, oh, I missed him, or, you know, whatever. And Hitchcock knows, like, this is so much better, so much more tense if we don't ever see that pilot.
And I kept thinking, like, who would they have gotten to do this? I mean, you're assuming it's a criminal network that has a number of people who can just get into a plane and terrorize someone. But I kept thinking it had to be one of their guys that we've seen all through the movie flying this plane. And it's why I thought maybe it was the two guys we saw at the beginning.
It was
one
of them.
But then they show, was it?
Yeah.
Because I thought we saw them after this. So
we saw one of them. Yeah, I think the unwritten thing they were going on was it was the other one of those guys was the guy that was flying the plane.
I saw the other dude later on too, and I was like, okay, well then who was it in there? I mean, it could have been anybody. That's the point. It's not really important. But if the movie is kind of like subtly saying it was this person, that's pretty cool too.
Yeah, I think that was the intent, at least from what I've read. Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm. I am remembering, and I brought this up on a podcast ages ago, and as we've been talking, I've remembered where I got the Bond stuff from, whereas he was trying to do his own Bond thing. It's the Anthony Hopkins movie Hitchcock, where he plays Hitchcock, and they say, MGM wants you to do the Ian Fleming book Casino Royale with Cary Grant. Definitely your style. And Hitchcock replies, doesn't she know I made that movie? It was called North by Northwest.
Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly.
But yeah, it's fun, by the way, if you ever get to the watch the North by Northwest disc and listen to that commentary. It's some pretty illuminating things from Ernest Lehman on that, who's old enough at this point. I think that I would date this commentary around 2000, 2001, because he refers to a William Goldman book that he talks about a scene. He talks about the crop duster scene and how it was written and how it ends up on the screen and all this other stuff. And Goldman goes right out and says Lehman is the author of this movie. It's not as Hitchcock as Hitchcock says it is or whatever. It's kind of an interesting thing there. But Lehman has some interesting things in there just talking about how making the movie, and he did research on all this different stuff about the United Nations and Mount Rushmore and all this, and how he met Hitchcock was interesting too. Apparently he was making Rear Window and Lehman knew Bernard Herrmann. And if it wasn't for the fact that he knew Bernard Herrmann, Bernard Herrmann would have never introduced him to Hitchcock, and there would have never been a North by Northwest, because this is an original screenplay. This wasn't something that they optioned off of a book or something like that. So you're learning all about that type of stuff, and what Lehman thinks is bad about the movie is fun. He doesn't go off. He loves this movie too. But listening to him talk about what's bad about the movie, or what doesn't work in the movie, or what scenes go on too long, those are all really interesting. And his relationship with Hitchcock all the way through it too is fun. But
I will say the other thing I wanted to mention, one of the things I've always found fascinating about Hitchcock is his storyboard process and how he edits the movie before he shoots it, is what people will say, basically. And the rumor is, at least this trivia I have read, is that his assembly cut of North by Northwest was only 5 minutes longer than the final cut ended up being.
Yeah,
he only cut 5 minutes out of his assembly. Like, that's how precise he saw movies before he would make them. He knew exactly what, you know, needed to be in there. So
believe that's something that Lehman brings up too, is like when he first saw it, the work print was not much different from what they eventually saw. So
it's wild stuff.
Very interesting. All right, well, let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Shh, be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
And I'll start us off here. I had there's one that's been named in the comments that I thought about for a bit, the Big Lebowski, because that one has a lot of it has the mistaken identity. It has, you know, someone who is basically trying to solve a mystery throughout. There's even the scene where, you know, in a very hilarious moment, the Jeff Bridges like does that pencil over the paper thing to find what was written on it before, you know, Big Lebowski, and in Big Lebowski, it just turns out to be a picture of somebody with a giant penis. And that's one of the funniest things ever. He's like, "Oh, I'm going to find out what's going on now." And it's just that. I wanted to kind of do this thing where it's a wrong man type of thing, a person who's trying to solve their own mystery, and I came up with The Fugitive for this one.
Nice.
The idea of, you know, obviously he's not being mistaken for someone else. He's just being mistaken as the true killer of his wife. And once he is set on that adventure, like he gets out of, you know, he breaks out of prison through that very convenient train that comes by and helps him get out of that situation. He starts wanting to solve his own mystery at that point. And so the whole thing is him getting chased around and then trying to solve the wife of his murder of his wife. So I thought that would be a good one to go along with North by Northwest.
All right. I have six listed. The chat and Dicer have killed two of them, but this is why I list more than one. I thought about The Game with Michael Douglas, and the chat mentioned that. I thought about pairing it with Arsenic and Old Lace because it is, again, Cary Grant. The tone is different, but it's, again, Cary Grant trying to figure out what's happening all around him that everybody else seems to know about. The nose one that I can't do would be Enemy of the State. My Jeremy pick for double feature, since I have now learned that North by Northwest didn't have a lot of deep meaning behind it, as I thought it might, I paired it with The Truman Show.
okay.
A movie where everybody else around the character in his world knows more about what's going on than he does. And I just think tonally there's enough drama and humor there that it would be a good matchup. And then going in naively thinking North by Northwest must mean something, I thought there'd be some good discussion afterwards about identity and who we are and who we let other people tell us to be.
I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, just because Hitchcock and Lehman say there's nothing there doesn't mean we can't.
There can't be anything there for us, right?
No, yeah, and that something that there can't be anything that as if there's not anything self-conscious in this work. I mean,
right.
Like I said, look at this philosophy paper that I was talking about. This guy comes up with stuff that's uncanny in it. A lot of it's rolling in your eyes, though. But, like, some of it is just uncanny. Like, is that really just a mistake that were just, like, on accident that they put that in there? Yeah, sometimes that happens. And I firmly believe that even if the creators say that there's nothing there, we can personally come up with those type of things, because I think all those type of things have – there are unconscious forces working on some of these works of art and, you know – why did they do a certain thing the way they did? Oh, I thought this would be a cool shot. Well, maybe you were also thinking subconsciously something else going on. But, you know, anyway, I think we can do that anyway.
I agree. I agree.
All right. That's going to do it for that. And so it'll be me next week. Next week, we are going to be doing the live show on Thursday at the same time. I have things going on at the house. I can't do things on a Tuesday. So we'll be doing it next Thursday. It is my turn to pick, and I am going to give a movie that we have mentioned quite a bit, I think, either on this podcast or the last two or these both podcasts that we've done. The Informant, Steven Soderbergh's comedy where Matt Damon lies constantly in a most hilarious fashion. This is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. I still don't understand the IMDb rating on this movie. I don't understand why nobody watched it. They tried their damnedest to try to get to people to be interested in corn syrup, but they did not get that. They did not get people interested in the devious dealings with corn syrup. But man, oh man, this movie's so funny, and the IMDb rating is wrong on this one. I mean, it's a high six. It's still in the decent territory, but it should be in the sevens. Come on, it should be in the sevens. And this is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen in my life.
I almost want to start talking about it right now. But I'll save it for next week. I adore this movie. I remember 5 or 6 years ago, there's a scene in this movie where he's in the bathroom changing one of the tapes in his recorder or whatever. And he looks down and he sees like part of a Cheeto or something on the ground, and some ants are like carrying it away. And he's like, well, that's just a big day for an ant right there. You got to, I forget exactly what he says, but I took that quote and a screenshot and I put it on Twitter, and it was crickets. Like, this movie is way underexposed, and I'm glad that we're going to do something to change that, at least within our sphere of influence.
Yeah, absolutely. So I didn't look up where this was all available.
It's not. You'll have to rent it.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what I always do, I think. I always pick the one you got
to
rent.
I'm going to need you guys to start doing some streamable ones, because I've got like a backlog of ones that you can only rent, but I always feel too guilty to throw out like a rent back-to-back when we've already done one the week prior.
Yeah.
I mean, anyway, there's always some level of invest. I mean, even if it's like on a streaming service, you're paying for the stream. There's always some kind of investment to see stuff, usually.
There is one movie, by the way, that I have wanted to do as a big recommend and will not ever be able to do it because it's just not available unless you buy the Blu-ray.
Mm.
And it's John Woo's The Killer, and I just want to... I want to recommend it big, and I can't... bigly, and I can't... I can never do it because... Everybody who has to watch it would either have to, I guess, pirate it, or they'd have to buy the Blu-ray. So, anyway. All right. I think that's going to do it for this week. Thank you again, chat, for coming out. Once again, so thankful for you guys coming out here. Remember, next week is Thursday. It'll be February 20th for the live show. For the people who just listen to us, there's no change to that. It's just going to come out the following Monday. But also, the following week will be our best of podcast. We will be doing the best of 2024, like we always do, the week before the Oscars. Live, you'll get to hear what we think before the Oscars, and then the people who listen to us on Monday will know what the Oscars winners are by that point, and we can look... like total dummies thinking what we thought would win the Oscar and everything. So anyway, that will be the following one. It'll be on the normal Tuesday unless something changes there. So anyway, that's going to do it for this week. We will see you next time.
Bye, everybody.
See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Hope we find your dad.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com. I am a human being.
That's right.
There was a guy at Hollywood 27 who used to answer the phone, and he was a manager. He would say, "Hello, welcome to Regal Cinemas. I am here to help you." And then often people would go, "Is this a real person?" And he goes, "This is a real person."
Remember when you used to be able to call big corporations, had call centers and shit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was kind of, in retrospect, that was kind of nice.
The most frustrating ever thing happened just before the end of the year. And I do have the notorious United Healthcare as my insurance. And I called them because the insurance that I had gotten previously, I had Cigna forever, but I had to change because my doctor, the whoever employed my doctor was not doing Cigna anymore and all this stuff. So I had to change from Cigna to this other place, to this United Healthcare. And like, I didn't know much about it because I didn't do much with my Cigna stuff that I didn't, when I applied for it, I didn't do anything really except just like, this is what I kind of want. And then I looked for the details on this new insurance and I thought I had it, but like I was paying exorbitant amounts for the drugs I needed. And like, I was like, what is the deal with this? I thought this covered this and everything. So I was like, I'm going to just have to change my insurance and look more carefully at what they're doing. But if you ever look at a health insurance website, this for people who are outside of the United States, this is just sounds insane, probably, like that you have to go through all of this. But they tell you that stuff is covered, but there's still like some cloudiness to the stuff that they're presenting on their website. Like it's like I don't know if I get this and I'm stuck with it for a year, I want to know for a fact that it covers the stuff. And so I ended up calling them and I got somebody who was like, oh yes, it says here you got the bronze. And I was like, yeah, I want to do the gold next year. So does it cover the stuff? And this person kept referring back to my current insurance to give me answers. And I said, no, I want to move to the gold next year. Does that cover that? And they just kept, it just kept cycling back. And I got very frustrated. And finally, I got someone who finally confirmed all the things that I was doing. They had to put me some other place. But I'm sitting there going, you know, this is like part of the deal, right? They don't want you to, I feel like they don't want you to know certain, they don't want their caller people to know what you're asking sometimes and get frustrated and you hang up and whatever. I just feel like that's part of the deal. It just, they don't want you to know everything.
Well, you saw the Rainmaker, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
you saw Incredibles, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I often compare the two movies.
Mm-hmm. It's frustrating enough to not have the kind of healthcare they have, like in Canada or the UK, you know, where you just go in and you know your government takes care of you. But the fact that the insurance companies and the healthcare companies become this shell game is infuriating. Because I was on United Healthcare for years. We switched to Cigna specifically because the hospital nearest us was Cigna friendly, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then within a year, our regular doctor stopped taking Cigna. Now Kroger has stopped taking Cigna. Like, no Kroger will accept Cigna insurance. So not only do I have to pay for insurance and then ultimately pay for all my own healthcare anyway, but I have to like hunt and peck to find the places that will even accept my insurance.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, let's fix it. Let's
yeah, that's going to happen.
The epitome of being in a, you know, being the strongest person in the world and feeling the weakest you can is being a worker at an insurance company.
I do love that aspect of The Incredibles because he is being a hero in that moment. And and once again, in the theme of the movie, he is not appreciated for it.
Correct. Correct. I hear about, I forget which country it is. Maybe one of you have heard this as well and can tell me, or I can look it up, whatever. Where you pay when you're healthy, not when you're sick. The idea being like you pay your doctors when they're doing their job well. So when you're healthy, you're making a subsidy payment to your doctor. And then when you're sick, they don't get paid. So they don't get paid again until you're well.
Oh, wow.
So
that is very good incentive for the doctors, huh?
Yeah. So it's an interesting system.
Sounds very Swedish, but I don't know if that's right.
We could do the Iron Monkey route where everybody pays what they're able, right? Like, because the Iron Monkey, he's a doctor in the daytime and he gives medicine to this woman for really cheap, and then the next guy comes up and it's the same medicine but he charges him a lot more, and the guy gets all angry and he's like, well, you can afford it and she can't. That's how much she could afford. Iron Monkey,
Iron Monkey
dish it out medical advice
will be the first time that Iron Monkey, Incredibles, and Rainmaker have been mentioned all in the same breath.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.